5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Happy Sunday, Croc Nation. This is your favorite cancer survivorship bus driver, Dr. Tommy and Ellie. Angel Santana, have faith, let it begin on the other side of the glass. Angel, what's happening?
¿Cómo estás, mi amigo?
I understand there's a couple of things going on in your life. Why don't you share it with our Croc Nation?
Where is there to start, my friend? We are...
Start at the beginning.
Well, back in 1978, no, I'm just kidding. So I am in the process of waiting for my wife to... What's the great terminology to make it fun?
Deliver?
I was trying to come up with a better word, like a funny word. Yes, I'm waiting to become a father for the second time. My son is due on the 25th. So we're just waiting. The baby's still cooking and doesn't want to come out yet.
Yeah, well, the baby's pretty cooked there, my friend Angel. And he's going to be a very lucky young man to have you and Rachel as his parents. And Croc Nation, I know you join me when we wish the most blessed and safe and healthy delivery for what will be a very, very, I will say, special young man. How's that sound, Angel?
I like it. I like it a lot.
So today, Angel, today, Croc Nation, January 23rd, 2022, we're going to be talking about healing. And I find it to be incredibly instructional, putting together your podcast every week, because I learn something every week that I didn't know. And we are going to be putting two papers together from our friend Raina and our friend Len Berry. And we're going to be looking at those two papers. Hopefully they'll be able to get back on the air as guests soon. I know Raina for sure, with the coronavirus, as a pulmonologist, is probably working her little tail off. And Len has been, I'm sure, very busy as well. So we're going to look at two of their papers.
Awesome.
The one today we're going to be looking at is putting healing back at the center of healthcare. Angel, when I use the word or you hear the word healing, what do you think about?
It's so funny you say this, because that's what we did on my show this week. And I know you haven't had a chance to binge listen to my show, but we did healing. So we're really
on the
page.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah,
we did. We're on the same page. Yeah,
we're really on there. So I can actually tell you from my own personal experience and also from the show I just did. When I think of the word healing, I think of recuperation. I think of bandages and scars that can heal. And that could be psychologically, mentally, and of course, from any type of procedure.
Gotcha. Well, I'll tell you what I thought healing was. I would thought as an oncologist that healing would be the complete eradication of cancer. But according to Raina and according to Len, again, putting healing back at the center of healthcare, the primary mission of healthcare is to facilitate healing. People often associate healing only with cure. That was my problem. But it is much broader. We have to look at it in a much, much bigger scope. A clinician heals when she reassures a patient that a symptom does not signal a feared health condition. So I always call it, talking a patient off the ledge. A treatment heals when it mitigates pain and slows progression of disease, not just eradicates the disease. Healing even occurs when a very sick patient dies at home, surrounded by family, instead of in a hospital attached to machines. Each unique instance of healing represents a physical and emotional journey through difficulty, toward contentment, and even peace. All patients need healing, and when clinicians and their institutions actively foster it, they renew themselves as well. So today's paper, today's lesson, today's message is going to be to take a different view of healing. Look at some of the factors that promote healing. We've already made a definition of healing. We've broadened the scope of the word to heal as the verb. And it doesn't just mean to cure. It could mean to quell, to help, to demystify, to mitigate, to take away pain, and to take away anxiety. So there's a lot of levels that I think many of us really never look at. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And it's so many different avenues. And I'm looking forward to the rest of this this episode because of it.
Awesome. So as I've always told you, there's not a day that goes by that a patient doesn't teach me something. So this week, I was involved in the care of a woman by the name of Virginia. I won't give you her real name, obviously. 10 years ago, I saw her, and she was 73 at the time. And I said, Virginia, you have breast cancer. You've had your surgery. You must, and let me repeat this, you must have radiation or your cancer will come back. And she was an extraordinarily good self-advocate. And we're going to get into that in today's podcast. She did all of her research. She did all of her reading. She was an amazing self-advocate. And she said, to be honest with you, I accept your opinion. I accept your recommendation as being valid and just. But according to my reading and the way I'm viewing this, I'm not going to do the radiation. And we kind of left it at that. We had a long discussion. And I was very, very much against that. And that was 10 years ago. Me as a doctor now is much different. I think I look at statistics a lot differently. I think I'm a lot more interested in engaging and employing and promoting the patient to become part of the process, where maybe 10 years ago, I would be more of a dictator than I am an egalitarian leader, and more of a pushy person than I am now, and probably more immature, even though I was in my 50s at the time. You know, it takes doctors a longer time to get, you know, to the place of maturity that most of the public does. And as it turns out, she presented this week to our tumor board, to our breast tumor board, with a new tumor. But indeed, she was right, and I was wrong. The tumor did not come back. She spent 10 years without having to deal with radiation, and she's going to get more surgery, and I'm sure she's going to be okay, maybe last another 10 years. And if she does come back to see me this time for potential radiation, I will certainly have a different position than I did 10 years ago. So again, every week, right, Angel, we learn from our survivors.
Amen to that. Wow.
Right? Healthcare is becoming less focused on what we thought would be the intrinsic goal of healing and more on the external forces. So we're going to talk about some of the things that actually stand in the way of our goal of healing a patient. Again, healing with the new broader definition. And things that you wouldn't really think about, Angel, as a layman. So there's a lot more regulatory oversight. There are now metrics upon metrics. So we get reports upon reports upon reports, bar graphs upon pie graphs upon forest plots of all of these margins that we're either hitting or not hitting. And it's really taking us away from our mission. Delivery models that are not in partnership with our communities. These all divert attention and energy away from the real driving force of change that we need to keep healing and the patient at the center of our energy. Clinicians and their institutions. So it's not just doctors out there, my colleagues. We also have to partner with our healthcare institutions in order to reclaim healing as our core aim, as our core value. And we need to recognize the threats, and we're going to get into these threats by prioritizing four key intersecting principles. And again, this is directly from Dr. Raina Audish and Dr. Len Berry. We're going to be talking about proximity, mutuality, kindness, and space or resilience. And kindness is going to be, to give you a sneak preview, the center of our podcast next week. We'll be talking about kindness in the medical care of our cancer patients. So let's talk about proximity. When you think about proximity, Angel, you think about closeness, right? But it's not closeness in the flesh. I mean, you know, we've already tried to emphasize the importance of doctors getting their eyes away from their computers washing their hands, looking at their patients, examining their patients, laying hands on their patients, as opposed to just high technical hands off or whatever. That's an important proximity. But I'm talking about proximity as it relates to decision making. So unfortunately, the decisions that are being made on behalf of our patients, quote unquote, healing, are being made by administrators, by insurance companies, and people that have never even met the patient, have never seen a picture of the patient, have never shaken the patient's hand, have never had to hand that patient a tissue to dry their tears. And many of these decisions occur far, far away from the bedside and the life of our patients. And that makes sense because many of these terrible decisions that are made that are in the interest of money, in the interest of the insurance companies, in the interest of administrators, small-minded administrators, what happens is that they don't have to look at the patient. They don't have to deal with the patient. And it's quite, quite horrible. The high-cost oncology drug that may not be on our formulary, but may offer a mother another year with her child who has cancer, that may not make sense on the ledger, that may not make sense on the bottom line, but boy, what a difference that makes in two people's lives or many people's lives, not just the mother and her child, but the entire family. And the level of impact for the child and for the mother is just, you know, I don't think there's a number that you can put on that value. I mean, that's amazing. Also, doctors are encouraged to see patients multiple times, but for very short, brief moments, sometimes 90 seconds, because those encounters generate revenue. But actually, is that a really good thing for the patient or for the doctor? It may look good on the revenue stream, but it sacrifices our ability to empathize, again, to heal our patients. How about when a healthcare institution is able to build empathy into the fabric of its operations, allowing clinicians to take the time to discuss with a newly diagnosed patient how each treatment option will affect their family, their own emotions, their work, their identity? The health of a community is also the responsibility of the doctors and the healthcare systems because they really face socioeconomic and racial disparities. This area in the Hudson Valley, Angel, as you know, does have some rural communities, some socioeconomically deprived communities, and with a lot of healthcare disparities because of people with color, some of the lower socioeconomic groups are ignored or not given access to the same medical care that other people just say in the Upper East Side in Manhattan would be able to have. So also communities need to be healed. So it's the patient's family, the healthcare system, and the communities that are all integrated in trying to achieve this healing process and try to push the proximity of the patient's, journey, the patient's story, the patient's narrative.
Right.
Closer, as opposed to letting administrators and insurance companies make these decisions. And it really doesn't matter what the bottom line looks like on a graph or on a piece of paper, especially with under or uninsured people. It really amounts to the care that they're entitled to. We'll talk a little bit about mutuality. And this is what we were talking about a little bit with Virginia. In matters of health, no one has all the answers, right? As we said with Virginia, there might be 3 out of 10 women that had a chance of having a recurrence of their breast cancer, such as Virginia, but there's also 7 out of 10 patients that would not recur. And here we're pushing these treatments for 3 out of 10 people, and there's 7 out of 10 people that don't need the treatment. The only problem is we don't know who the 3 people are. So we offer these treatments to all 10. You know, is that really a good way of looking at it? We really don't know all the facts. And the success or failure of healing depends greatly on the pooling of knowledge and information. So the clinicians, patients, we have to operate together. We have to you know, develop a climate of trust, a climate of respect, of transparency and humility, and require organizational support to do so. Mutuality requires that patients be viewed as the rightful owners of their medical records. I have a story for you. There's a doctor, kind of well-known doctor in New York City, even has a radio show on Sunday morning.
Oh, really?
I won't mention his name, Gil Lieberman. But, you know, I know that, you know, he is a real piece of work. And I know that Dr. Lieberman does not relinquish his medical records. So if a patient, God forbid, leaves his care and wants to get care somewhere else, say here at Garnet, he won't release the records, even if the patient wants them.
That's so illegal?
I don't know. All I know is that, well, I can say this so he doesn't sue me for slander. He has never released any records to me, despite written requests and the like. And he wears the patients out where they just say, forget it. It's not even worth the fight. Mm. So it's quite funny. But I think, you know, and again, I kind of pick on Dr. Lieberman, rightfully so. But I think there's a lot of doctors that view these charts as their property. And I think a lot of doctors, especially in the old days, I would see patients looking over and seeing what their doctors are writing, and the doctors are kind of hiding it, you know, like it's a test, and the patients are cheating. We're very good here. We're like, hey, these are your records. You basically just allow us the privilege of being the stewards, you know, of your medical records, but make no mistake about it. These medical records are yours. You own them. Now there's a process to get them. I can't just hand you the original medical record. You have to go through channels, but make no mistake that those medical records are, those patients are entitled to that information. Mutuality requires that patients be viewed as the rightful owners of their medical records and of their story. Each patient's story is unique and they own their own story. Only then will they be empowered to become full participants in their own healthcare. And you would agree with that. You have actually changed doctors recently.
Yeah, I have.
You know, or one of your family members, I think it was Ariel maybe.
Yeah, we did a change with the, you know, pediatrician. We just didn't feel comfortable, which we, anybody who's listening to this podcast will know, we've done things like the waiting room. You know, I encourage them to go back and listen, but yes, we have changed it based on not feeling comfortable with our care giver.
And I think another really good word is being judgmental. I think when we're talking about mutuality, you know, with patients being part of their decision-making, you know, and we've done a whole module on shared decision-making, but mutuality allows us to partner with another person without judgment or needing to be in control of his or her journey. I think with Virginia, as an example, again, me 10 years ago, I gave her my opinion, which was a valid, you know, binding opinion. You know, representing the standard of care. However, you know, I also was very judgmental to Virginia. I thought, you know, if you don't agree with me, then you're wrong. You know, that's the definition of being judgmental. And she was right. And quite frankly, if someone told me or was to behave that way with me, I wouldn't trust them. I wouldn't feel that I was part of a team. And, you know, I would feel being judged. I wouldn't want to have that person on my team. So true healing can only occur if patients are given agency, choice, and their individualism. Healing does not occur if the patients are shamed or judged, lacking health literacy. Many of my patients may not have done, even finished eighth grade. We have a lot of dairy farmers up here in the Hudson Valley, but I'll tell you, they have more common sense than probably 10 or 20 doctors all strung together. And they do have the common sense. I mean, medicine, you know, I think is this black hole, this little holy, you know, oracle of knowledge and intelligence and all that type of thing. But to be honest with you, you know, it's really not that hard. And of course, there's a lot of things that are hard. But if you were to simplify actually what was going on, you can basically explain to a patient in plain English what's going on that they could understand in their mind, to the same level that we understand it, even on a very molecular or atomic level. You know, there are no secrets. I mean, it's not that, you know, it's not rocket science. And it's not brain surgery, even when it is brain surgery, it's not brain surgery. So, you know, for the patients to let you know that you don't have to have a medical background to really have an idea of what's going on with you and to be able to have an opinion that should be respected. They're also overwhelmed with data that they can't absorb. And we that's our job to help them absorb their situation. So in closing of this particular subtopic, to heal, patients must feel safe and being honest, making mistakes. We have to give them room to make mistakes, ask questions, even if they have asked the same question 10 times, you can't make them feel bad about it. And in being guided gently, not with judgment, not with shame, but with, you know, acceptance and with love by people who care, with clinicians who care. When clinicians share power with patients, so that's in essence what we're doing to help them with this mutuality and healing, we have to give them that power. The challenging work of healing can become more joyful and rewarding, but not just to the patient angel, also to the provider, to me, to my nurse practitioners, to my nurses. In this way, it can offer one antidote for us being burnt out. Again, another module we did on burnout, another way to prevent burnout from happening. Let's allow some space for our patients. In healthcare, it's impossible to avoid suffering. There's just no way around it. Suffering, unfortunately, according to Viktor Frankl, an Austrian neurologist and psychologist, well, very well known in the world of healing, has written immensely. He's not with us anymore, but he was a big influence. Described suffering as an ineradicable part of life. So without suffering and human death, life cannot be complete. And we, in healthcare, it's impossible to avoid the suffering. So we need to let our patients suffer. Now, be careful when I say that. I don't mean let them suffer like, hey, you know, you're supposed to be in pain.
Right.
I'm not going to give you anything that, for your pain. I don't mean that. And that should be another entire module, is that how bad we are as oncologists taking away pain from our patients. But for clinicians to heal, they must make emotional and spiritual space for all of the patients who suffer around them. Offering patients emotional and spiritual space can allow hope to evolve when cure is not possible. So we go from a very sad and scary place to a focused hope that centers on cure or remission or pain relief. As we said, again, we're broadening our definition of healing to intrinsic hope that values broader meaning. Again, we are broadening the meaning of the word healing. Also self-identity, quality of life. All of these have to be placed in the prioritization of the word healing and the verb healing and the process of healing. Mm-hmm. And as the end of life nears, we have to make peace with the lived experience of illness. So we have to deal with that. I mean, yeah. We just have to.
Yeah.
It's much more difficult for clinicians to support their patients if they don't feel the organization. So we also have to feel that our healthcare systems support us. We need them to buy in, because if we get burnt out, we're not going to be able to allow the space for the patients to get what they need, because we're going to be in pain. We're going to need space. So an example is that we have to have some of the burdens and responsibilities relieved from us in order for us to achieve what we need to do with our patients. So the healthcare system has to reduce some of our administrative and some of our other burdens. So our goal is to give the people who care for patients the time and energy to study, reflect, breathe, and feel the joy in their work, so that they in turn can offer patients and their families the space they need to find the resilience in the face of illness. So I thought that's a really good subsection, right? So far, just to go back, we are broadening the term of healing, and we're going to do that by getting personal, getting proximal. We're going to share power and mutuality with the patient. We're going to give them space to allow them to be resilient, but at the same time, imploring our healthcare systems to give us the tools, reduce the burden so we could provide the space for the patient, because we need to have joy in what we're doing in order to produce a healing atmosphere. And I'm going to just touch briefly on the fourth pillar of this paper, which is kindness, because next week's episode is going to be completely on kindness, on another paper by Raina and Len. And kindness fosters a culture of trust. So that's a sneak preview for next week, a sneak peek. So clinicians who work to understand the complex emotions that diagnosis and treatment evoke, and then show kindness to patients as they face those challenges, that can mitigate some of the suffering, healing, that illnesses confer. Kindness helps to heal not just the recipient, but also the giver, you know, the caregiver as well, the doctors, the nurses, the physical therapists, the occupational therapists. Kindness can be learned. So some people have it more ingrained in their DNA, but it's not that if you're not, you know, kind de novo, just in your own personality, you can learn kindness. And we have to start by embedding it into our culture, the culture of our organization, because protocols for safe administrations of medications, of radiation, of surgical checklists to make sure that you're not cutting out the wrong organ or the wrong limb or whatever, those are embedded into our systems. We also have to embed kindness into our systems. So there are things that we'll be talking about next week that relate to kindness, like deep listening, empathy, generous acts. We did an entire module on generosity, timely care, gentle honesty, and support for family caregivers. All of this earns the patient's trust, which is essential for the patient-clinician partnership that healing requires. The absence of kindness, the absence of trust, can lead to patients feeling like hostages. We've talked about this, to their care and the patients who deliver it. Len and Raina call that the hostage bargaining syndrome, and it really thwarts the healing motivation. I'll give you an example of my dog. So, you know, dealing with a pet with a disability, you know, we live in a very rural area, and you know, the local care, you know, is just very subpar. You know, I don't mean to disparage any of the local vets, but you know, my dog was walking or not walking with, you know, the diagnosis of arthritis when she had a you know, another problem with her spinal cord, and you know, by a miracle, and again, we believe in miracles on this podcast, we found some doctors out in Brewster, New York, which is like an hour and a half away, but they really know what they're doing, and you know, they saved my dog's life. Unfortunately, you know, she has to live with a disability, which may have been prevented, but you know, that's the difference. The difference is, you know, we were hostages. We felt that there was no way, you know, it's like people going to doctors they don't trust, people going to doctors that don't really have the level of experience or expertise that's necessary. And quite frankly, even as a doctor, even as a graduate school educated, my wife is also has a doctorate. I mean, we're not dumb people. You know, we felt hostage. We felt like we were being terrorized. We were hostages because we didn't know what else to do. And this was right during coronavirus too, when many vets weren't even seeing any new, you know, new dogs or cats or whatever. So imagine having a sick, you know, pet. Imagine, forget about a pet, having a sick family member, and you're like in, you know, in a rural community and nobody's really helping you and you're getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And what do you do? Like, can you, and you can't go into New York because of coronavirus. So what do? You just sit home and die? I mean, you know, so we're going to talk about that next week. A lot to say about that. So just to conclude, and I'm looking at my little egg timer at 26 minutes and 47 seconds. Healthcare plays a unique and sacred role in society. Our role is to provide healing, and it is up to its leaders, and not just the doctors, but the healthcare systems, to reclaim the primacy, which is a great word, primacy, of this role before it's too late. Healing requires more than medication. It requires more than technology. And it requires emotional and spiritual rehabilitation. And it also requires emphasis on the healing of the people doing the healing. Angel Santana, any last words?
I think we touched base very well. I'm looking forward to the next week's episode too, about kindness and everything like that. So it was a good sneak peek for that. I only have one question. It goes back to the, in the fairly beginning, I wanted to ask it then, but it's like, yeah, let me see what happens. When we talked about, and not to belittle the point, but when a doctor's back then or didn't want to release the medical information, so to speak, would you say that that's also something that was practiced, you know, more back when you were in school as well? Was that something like a normal?
Yeah, I think definitely we felt that the medical records were not the patient's property. As a matter of fact, you know, I remember a couple of times when patients, these were in the days of, you know, those binder charts, you know, when we were, you know, we had those big blue, big charts that you know, and I remember like patients stealing their charts and looking at them and being yelled at. And like, that was like, there was the doctor's rack that would be held under, you know, in the nurse's area, and patients couldn't look at their records or look at the results. Now look where we are. We have my chart, patients have access, you know, you don't give a patient a result or whatever, or they ask for their records and you don't give it to them. You know, what did Mr. T used to say? I pity the fool. So yeah, I mean, that's the way things were. And actually that's the way things still are. I think in many places.
Wow. Yeah, that was my only question.
I think we're trying to hold people back from like it's really awesome for us. Like, you know, and I say that very sarcastically. It's awesome for us to have very naive and you know, uninformed patients. You know, it makes our life so much easier. Again, sarcastic. It makes our day so much easier. We can get it in and out, and we don't have to worry about it. And everyone does exactly what we say, and that's the end of it.
But, you know, just to quickly make a funny joke about this topic that I just brought up, even with the people that really want those medical records, like myself included, we want to take ownership. We need to know the results, right? But what happens? We get the results, we can't read them. So we can call you anyway.
But that's our job. You know, as a matter of fact, one of the biggest problems that we really remind me, let's do a podcast on this. What happens when patient portals post the results of a test before their doctors have had a chance to explain it to them? I think almost 100%, now there's never such a thing as 100%, but 90% of the patients who call me absolutely ready to buy a cemetery plot because they read a report that actually was a benign negative report, but they read it positively because of the big words and the way things were, you know, spoken of. We really need to do a podcast on that.
Mark that down, folks.
Yeah, exactly. Angel Santana, have faith, let it begin. Thank you for everything.
Always, my friend, always.
Rod Freeman, Small Biz Up, thank you for everything. I've been in touch with Rod. We're doing great things. Thank you, Rod. I can't thank you enough. You're wonderful. Anybody out there who needs a friend, if you have a small business, he's your guy. John, Michael John Benzea, and Charlotte Larson, thank you for your belief in us. To the board of directors who are working so hard, and if they don't, me and Angel are going to come after you with sticks and flames, and we're going to be torches. We're going to be following you with pitchforks, you know, through the Hudson Valley to make sure you work for our cancer survivors. And of course, last word always on behalf of the board of directors, Angel Santana and myself. You are the greatest cancer survivors. You guys rock. You guys are the greatest. You deserve everything. Anything we can do for you, you know, please ask. Contact us. We have a lot of resources for you guys. Got a bunch of books out there. We have my friend Dr. Hargis's book. We have Raina Audish's book. We have other things. We had offered you some free music lessons and whatever to make music. Please contact us. Contact us. 31 minutes, 49 seconds. I'm going to end as I end every podcast. On behalf of everyone, we wish you the longest, healthiest, happiest, cancer-free life. God bless you. God be with you. God help you. God protect you. We love you. We adore you. Peace.